On today's Bill of the Fleta Show, episode 170, Snowballs, Catfights, WMDs, and Real Value. All of this and more. The Fleta Show, starring Kenty and Jose. Welcome to the Fleta Show. A low-calorie carbonated beverage for my diet. That was a weird opening. It didn't really click. Welcome to the Fleta Show. I am Kenty, your host, and my co-host Jose is shopping at Bloomingdale's. How you doing? It's been a long time since I've done a regular Fleta Show. Just so you know, I have not gotten my new computer yet, though I have had some people donate some money. I'm still saving for it. I'm still have to wait a little while longer to see if I'm going to be getting some money. But I want to get the new computer. Well, first of all, let me tell you, is Tim from Tastes Like Burning has helped me set up a way that I can do shows, gave me some ideas, and so I am doing that. That's what I'm doing today. I'm not really sure how regular these Fleta shows are going to be before I get the new computer. Let me give you an idea to what I want to do is with my I'm going to do some other things with the Fleta Show. One is I like to do some more videos, which I've been have a bunch of videos. I just did a video. Hope you liked it. I liked it. I've gotten some good responses from it. I also like to do some more stuff with the ukulele. And there are a number of songs that I have done in the public domain, which I would like to prepare a book, a song book, for, you know, ukulele songbook. Anybody can, you know, use it. It'll basically be the melody line and the chords for the ukulele. And, and offer it for sale. And that I need to have a better computer than what I have. Better than the laptop, even. Something a little faster. And also bigger, because, I mean, the laptop is small. All right, my MacBook, and I need to buy a, I need to get a program, music program. So that's one of the things I'd like to do, to actually have some sort of solid contribution from the Fleta Show. I'd also like to get together a book of exercises detailing what I do and helping other people attain the goals that they want in exercise. And I'm going to be talking more about my exercise next week. Well, probably not next week. Next week I'm going to be putting up a video. Sissy Fudge Packer Sissy Fudge Packer presents a series of videos that teach you about different topics. So next week will be banks and credits. And I'm going to put that up. I want to do some other things. It was really odd doing the show, doing the sequences and stuff, some of the sequences, because I was like, I'm so out of touch with it. I haven't really thought about doing them. And I mean, I've thought about things during these past weeks I'd like to talk about, but when it came to sitting down and talking about them, I wasn't as enthused about it, I guess. I mean, some sections more than others. But I guess if you don't use it, you lose it. So it might be a few weeks before I get back to the swing of things. So these past few weeks I've been doing other things. I'm trying to clean up my room here to make some more order in my life. It's not disordered, but I want to like consolidate. So I did get rid of some stuff, but there's some other stuff I want to get rid of too, which I think I might have talked about on the previous podcast, but I'm not really sure how to go about it. I just don't want to throw it away. And, cause I think there's value there. I mean, I could sell it or, you know, give it to a university or something. I don't want to, you know, I don't know. I say I don't know a lot, which is not very good because it doesn't really, you know, I don't know how that helps anybody. It sort of annoys me that I think about it. I say it a lot. Oh, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. As if I'm, you know, I'm at a loss. It's like I've run out of rope, you know? And, of course, I guess the answer is to just make a decision and go with it. I mean, you know, I'm one, I guess, I think of an argument, I think of both sides of the argument. So I come to a point, I'm like, well, whatever, you know, both of them could come out equally, but I guess you have to take one side or the other and then just follow through with it, right? You can't be namby-pamby. I mean, either something is or isn't, right? Maybe. I don't know. Maybe that's the, you know, maybe there is no right or wrong, you know. There's just, it all depends on the situation. Situational ethics. What do you think about that? Situational ethics. So, okay, so let's say you can call me at 206-984-3617. I appreciate all of my listeners who have been in contact with me over the past few weeks. Also, come to theflatishow.com. When you get there, you know, click, it takes you to the blog. And along the right, you'll see several things which you can do. One of which is sign up for the email at the on the blog, and this will sign up through Feedburner. And every time I post something to the blog, you'll be sent an email. I have to look into that because I just changed over. Google, you know, had bought out Feedburner, and they just changed over the feed, so my feed is new. So that's something I have to check the feed address on my links. Feed address. On links, and also check the email thing portion of that. I'll have to look at that. Facebook and Twitter, you can follow me there. There's links. And again, there's the new computer, which I'm still looking for. Is that it? I guess this is going to be a shorter beginning than I thought. I just don't really have anything to say. And that's bad. That's sad. I don't have anything to say. I mean, I do have things to say, but I'm in a kind of a mellow mood, so anyway, you know, I'll talk to you, I'll be in touch, so on with the show.
Lash! That's Brenda Starr you hear, finishing up her scoop just for you.
Brenda Starr! Hi kids, the Brenda Starr update. The last time I updated Brenda Starr is Brenda found Aurora and Basil, and were they getting into leather? Because Aurora had her high-heeled shoes right on Basil's chest, and he was bare-chested. So what happens is, before we can find out whether they're getting into leather, Brenda interrupts and breaks into the room and finds that Basil has been drugged. So she confronts Aurora, and Aurora tells Brenda, "You better get downstairs, girlfriend, before you get hurt." And but before that can happen, we go downstairs and see that Ringo has Bentley Price at gunpoint, and then he tells Trad, "Go get Basil and Brenda." So we go back upstairs, and Brenda has had enough, and they start to fight. It's a cat fight over Basil because, you know, Aurora is talking shit like, "Oh, Basil's mine," and he said he wasn't interested in you anymore. And, of course, you know, this is making Brenda angrier and angrier because, you know, she's had a long history with Basil. And we find out that Aurora has drugged Basil because he backed down on the deal they had to peddle Kazuki artifacts. He realized that it was wrong to take these artifacts from the country and sell them. So Brenda finally knocks out Aurora, and she is unconscious. And as she's taking care of Basil, Ringo busts in the door and says, "Come with me, and, you know, we're going to save you and Basil." And Brenda's like, "What? Well, how could I trust you?" But she has to, because, I mean, what else is she going to do? So Ringo picks up Basil and takes Brenda Starr, and they're outside, and Trad is shuffling them in the car as crowds gather. And so, you know, what's going to happen? Will Basil turn into a junkie? Will Brenda Starr decide to join a professional women's wrestling team? And what about Sage? Is he still asleep? And will he marry Miella? We'll find the answers to these questions next week. Real American History. The eve of the revolution. The quarrel between the colonies and the mother country grew more and more bitter. "Pay the taxes," declared King George, "or I will send my soldiers over and make you." "We will not pay taxes," replied the colonists, "unless we can have something to say about making the laws." The two regiments of British soldiers were sent to Boston. The people were angry and insulted the redcoats. "What right have these soldiers in Boston anyway?" they asked. The boys laughed at the British and called them lobsterbacks. "Lobsterbacks! Kill the lobsterbacks!" shouted the crowd when the troops paraded the streets on Sunday morning. In winter, the boys used to coast down to the frog pond in the common. They became excited when they saw the redcoats going into camp close by. The soldiers, as the story goes, used to tease the youngsters by spoiling their sledding. One day, having rebuilt their slides and finding on their return from school that they were once again destroyed, several of the boys went to the captain and complained. The officer made fun of them, and the soldiers became more troublesome than ever. At last, a party of some of the larger boys waited on General Gage, the commander-in-chief. He asked why so many children had called on him. "We come, sir," said the tallest boy, "to demand satisfaction." "What?" said the general. "Have your fathers been teaching you rebellion and sent you to exhibit it here?" "Nobody sent us, sir," replied the boy, while his eyes flashed and his cheeks grew red. "We have never injured or insulted your troops, but they have spoiled our snow slides and broken the ice on our skating grounds. We complained, and they called us young rebels and told us to help ourselves if we could. We told the captain, and he laughed at us. Yesterday, our slides were destroyed the third time, and we will bear it no longer." General Gage was a kind-hearted man. After gazing on the boys in silent admiration for a moment, he turned to an officer by his side and said, "The very children here draw in a love of liberty with the air they breathe. You may go, my brave boys, and be assured that if my soldiers trouble you again, they shall be punished." One winter day, a crowd of Boston schoolboys pelted one of the hated tax collectors with snowballs and drove him into his house. The man opened a window and rashly fired a gun at random. A boy named Snyder was killed. A few days later on the common, there was trouble between the soldiers and some rope makers. The redcoats got the worst of it. One night in March 1770, some soldiers stationed in Boston got into a quarrel with the people, and the noise increased until the guard was called out. When the regulars drew up in line, most of the crowd fell back. A few remained and insulted the redcoat soldiers, shouting, "Lobsterbacks, fire if you dare, you cowards. You don't dare to fire." Well, Captain Preston, the officer in command, gave the word, "Fire!" The soldiers fired. 5 men were killed and several wounded. There was now intense excitement in Boston. The next day, the Old South Church was crowded with an angry town meeting. Thousands filled the streets. The people demanded that the troops be removed. The governor promised to remove one regiment. "Both regiments or none," was the answer. Samuel Adams waited on the governor. Stretching forth his long right arm and pointing his finger at him, he sternly demanded, in the name of 3,000 freemen, that every British soldier be removed from Boston. "I observed his knees to tremble," said the stern patriot in after years. "I saw his face grow pale, and I enjoyed the sight." Before sunset of the same day, the British troops were removed from the city and sent to an island in the harbor. Not until after did the meeting in the Old South Church break up. The unfortunate act of the soldiers in killing the people was the so-called Boston Massacre. It did more to mold public opinion than weeks of fine talk could have done. It was one step, and an important one, toward the final appeal to the bayonet. The quarrel did not stop. 3 years had passed, and King George had taken the tax off everything except tea. "We don't mind the tax of a few cents on a pound of tea," said the people. "This is not the point. You have no right to tax us unless we can help to make the laws. Buy the taxed tea or go without." Three of the king's ships landed their tea in Charleston, South Carolina, but nobody would sell it. It was hid in a damp cellar and left to spoil. In vain, the royal officers tried to land tea in New York and Philadelphia. The ship owners were glad to send their unloaded vessels back to England. In Boston, things took a different turn. Warning was several times given to the masters of the ships to sail out of the harbor. On the last day, before the tea must be landed or be prevented from landing, a town meeting was held in the Old South Church. There was a crowd in the church and in the streets. The discussion continued until dark, and candles were brought in. It was decided that the tea should not be landed. "Who knows," shouted somebody in the audience, "how tea will mix with salt water." The church rang with cheers. Then up rose Samuel Adams and said, "This meeting can do nothing more to save the country." This was the signal. A war whoop was heard outside, and 40 or 50 men, disguised as Indians, went quietly aboard the three vessels. Before the 9 o'clock bell rang, 342 chests of tea had been cut open and their contents emptied into Boston Harbor. The next morning, there was not a chest of taxed tea in Boston, on shipboard or on shore. At the same time, Paul Revere was riding with all haste to Philadelphia to let the good people of that city know that Boston was ready to fight for her rights. One of the Indians found a handful of tea in his shoe. He saved it and sealed it in a bottle. It is still shown as a souvenir of this informal tea party in Boston Harbor. This was the famous Boston Tea Party. It took place in the middle of December 1773. There was not the slightest disorder. The Indians quietly went back to their homes. The people of the 13 colonies showed every sign of joy when the swift riders carried the good news everywhere. Again, I've more to do than simply get the message through. I haven't started. Let's get this show on the road. Let's make it obvious Perone is off and rolling. Eyes, hair, mouth, figure, dress, voice, style, movement, hands, magic, rings, glamour, face, diamonds, excitement. I came from the people, they need to adore me, so Christian Dior me, from my head to my toes. I need to be dazzling, I want to be rainbow. They must have excitement, and so must I. figure, dress, voice, style. I'm their product. It's vital you sell me, so Machiavel me, make an Argentine rose. I need to be thrilling, and I shall be rainbow high. They need their escape, and so do I. Eyes, hair, mouth, figure, dress, voice, style, movement, hands, magic, rings, glamour, face, diamonds, excitement. All my desimisados expect to outshine the enemy, the aristocracy. I won't disappoint them. I'm their savior, that's what they call me. So Lauren Bacall me, anything goes. To make the fantastic, I have to be rainbow high in magical colors.
Isn't it interesting that Israel decided to invade Palestine, Palestine, right? No, Gaza Strip. Let me get it right. At the last 20 days of George Bush's term in office. I don't think it's a coincidence that they pulled out, you know, after, you know, right around the time that Obama was inaugurated. Now, you know, a country certainly has a right to defend itself. And I'm sure that, you know, the Hamas has, you know, been meddlesome or troublesome to Israel. However, why is Israel targeting hospitals and civilians and schools? That's what I don't understand. And I also don't understand these reports I'm finding that they have used these new weapons that no one knows about. Apparently, they've been developing weapons, and such as white phosphorus. And there's this other weapon which was described on Michael Moore's blog, which, you know, I'm taking with a grain of salt because he annoys me, Michael Moore. But it makes me think that somebody said that Israel went into Gaza to try out their new weapons, you know, to show their might, so to speak. I think, you know, I was reading on a website about the Israeli Defense Army, the Israeli Army, IDF. Pardon me. And it's their job. It's really interesting. I should read the. Let me pause here. Hold on, let me go. Well, here's something interesting on the IDF website, is that they have this vacation thing, this summer training program in Gadna for the diaspora Jews living abroad between the ages of 15 and 18 years of age. So if you're Jewish and you have a child who's between 15 and 18, you can send them to Israel, and they can learn about absorption, geographical survey, introductory remarks. Hold on, this is what it says, the itinerary. The purpose is strengthening the bond between the IDF, the State of Israel, and young Jews from the diaspora. The itinerary, absorption, geographical survey, introductory remarks, opening ceremony, hike, and closing ceremony. Weapons training, introduction to the weapon, loading and disassembling the weapon, gripping and shooting, preparation for shooting range. Field survival training, history of IDF operations such as Entebbe. Introductory courses in the IDF, flag and national anthem, prisoners of war and soldiers missing in action, ranks, insignia.
So, you know, I don't know what to think about this. I really don't. I mean, how many of our, you know, how like, if I were a dual citizen, right, and I had dual citizenship between the United States and, let's say, Germany, or say, Iran, say I was half Iranian and half American, what do you think would happen if I decided to go into training in the Iranian army? I would be kicked out of the country as called a traitor. And, you know, of course, you know, Israel is our ally, right? But what difference does it make, you know? I don't know. I don't see any difference. But whatever, Mary. So anyway, if you go search for the IDF, it comes up on Google. Here's the Google. And they have a... I thought it was really interesting. I should pause again to find what it is I find interesting. Hold on. Okay, one good thing about the IDF is that it allows open homosexuals to fight and to, you know, rise in rank, as well as women. But here's the main doctrine. It says here, the main doctrine consists of the following principles. Basic points. Israel cannot afford to lose a single war. Defensive on the strategic level, no territorial ambitions. So apparently they don't really care about taking over territories. They don't want to increase the size of Israel. They just want to defend it. That's how I take that. Desire to avoid war by political means and a credible deterrent posture. Credible deterrent posture. Now, do you think their invasion in Gaza was a means of showing that they have a credible defensive posture, that they can defend themselves? I mean, killing children, I mean, that really shows a lot of, you know, chutzpah, right, on the part of Israel, you know, makes them credible that they can kill people, I guess. I'm just really pissed, you know, I mean, you know, and then afterwards they were saying, like, because, you know, after they blew up, you know, all these people in Gaza, Hamas is coming out, giving people, you know, money and rebuilding as Israel withdraws. Why doesn't Israel go and, you know, give money to these Palestinians in Gaza before Hamas does? Become better than Hamas, you know? But no, you know? You know, maybe I'm just a simple man, but, you know, I have to bring it, I have to at least make the effort to talk about it, because it just fucking annoys me, you know? And who am I? I'm nobody. You know, that's Emily Dickinson. Who am I? I'm nobody. But what do you think about this? I mean, okay, here it is, more basic points. Preventing escalation, which really worked great in their Gaza experiment. Determine the outcome of the war quickly and decisively, and which they didn't finish in Gaza. What was their point? They went in and killed 4,500 people. And it wasn't like they were soldiers, you know? I don't know. Combating terrorism. Ugh, that's, you know, combating terrorism. That's the watch cry of the 21st century. I'm tired of terrorism. And a very low casualty ratio. I like that one. What's the very low casualty ratio mean? Is it ratio of... what is the ratio of soldiers to non-combatants? Or Israeli soldiers to the enemy soldiers? Or what does that mean? Very low casualty ratio. You know, and I'm picking on Israel because they're in the news, okay? And also the fact that there's a section of the United States which is just like, you know, rims Israel, every little thing they do. And, you know, I've talked about this. I mean, yeah, Israel is a democracy, and, you know, I know people who love Israel, you know, and not just because they think it's, you know, a place to, you know, that they're Jews that, you know, don't believe it's, you know, the promised land, like in a biblical sense. I don't know what to think. I really don't know what to think. I did a little video. Did you see the video? And that is because of what I heard on a podcast, and I couldn't believe it. But apparently, there is a fellow on Facebook, a friend of mine, Jim, who I think might be World Traveler Jim, and he says that it's absolutely true that the Israelis actually called the Palestinians on the cell phone. He didn't really say that in so many words. I actually asked him to clarify. But my point is if you're invading a country, right, why are you telling people, okay, it's like this. It's like this. Yeah, there's a hospital that takes care of people. It's like the Red Cross. You know, we're going to blow you up. We're going to blow up that hospital. You better get out. First of all, isn't it illegal to blow up hospitals and stuff like that? I mean, even if the enemy is supposed to be in there, I mean, to blow up the hospital, I mean, you would think that, you know, in certain situations like that, is that you surround the building, you know, with people and go in like that, you know, like with snipers or whatever. But no, they blow up the hospital. They blow up schools. They blow up orphanages. That's wrong, you know? I mean, they should thank God that he doesn't exist, because if he did exist, Israel would be obliterated. I mean, it's just like these old biblical stories, how Israel, the story of Israel is, you know, gets, you know, evil because they go against God. Read the fucking Ten Commandments, you know? Not that I think that, you know, that's, you know, I mean, you know, it's, I guess, a good guideline, but I'm not saying there's any kind of divine reason to follow it. So I guess, you know, as you know my position here. Yeah, I believe in God, but I also believe in the possibility that he doesn't exist. And I certainly don't want to push my beliefs on anybody in that way. My beliefs in a irrational concept like God. I don't know what to say. Like, how can I? What is my basis for railing against Israel? You know, I mean, it seems like the fashionable thing to do, but I don't know. What do you think? What do you think? That's it. That's all. That's all I'm gonna say about it. If I even said anything.
Yesterday may linger forever, today may never be felt, tomorrow may never come, tomorrow may never come. Yesterday may haunt us forever, today may pass in fear, tomorrow may never come, tomorrow may never come. All we have is you and I, feeling the wind and the sky. Reach me, touch me, hold me, hold me while my lips are still soft. Yesterday may stop us forever, today may never be found, tomorrow may never come, tomorrow may never come. All we have is you and I, feeling the wind and the sky. Reach me, touch me, hold me, hold me while my lips are still warm. Reach me, touch me, reach me, touch me, hold me, hold me, are still warm.
Our current crisis. Well, you know, if you've been reading the news, I mean, things don't look good with the financial market. You know, we're propping up banks left and right. But, I mean, you know, that's just one indication that, you know, something has been going wrong for a long time. And, you know, prior to deregulation in the late, you know, at the end of the Clinton administration, your banks required that people who wanted to buy, you know, real estate and homes put down, you know, 20%. And, you know, this is an indication that, you know, these people had the, were able to save the money and, you know, put down, you know, they're putting an investment into the house. You know, they're putting up their share. And, which is fine and dandy if the prices of houses, you know, remained fairly stable in line with, you know, income. But I know, I for one, I don't think I would have had been able to save ever, you know, for a down payment on a house. You know, meaning that because of the deregulation, John and I were able to buy our condo. We had some down. I think it was like 10%. We had 10%, and we were able to do that. That was, you know, dig that up. But houses are so damn expensive, and condos are so damn expensive, that, you know, you're restricted as to what you could buy. We just happened to find a place at the right price at the right time. And I think that, you know, when we bought it, was at a good price. You know, that was the value of the condo. And our, actually, the value of the condo has sort of remained fairly steady, so we're lucky. But I was also, and I remember when we were buying, the real estate agent was like, oh, you can go up a little bit more. You can buy this, you can buy that. And I was telling him, no, you can't. I said, because I know. I said, this is our price. This is what we can afford. I said, we're planning that we need to, you know, pay for maintenance and all sorts of things, you know, the bills, you know, we just can't consider the price of that house, you know. And he was telling us all kinds of crap, like, oh, well, you can get a, you know, interest-free loan and stuff. And we would have been in the same, you know, we would have been in problems if, you know, if I had been stupid or if we hadn't known. I knew to get a 30-year fixed rate. And I was firm about what we could spend. And it paid off, you know. Now, the credit market, banks aren't lending to anybody. They're only lending to people who can put down 20% now. Which, you know, leaves me in the shitter if I had to, you know. I mean, there has to be a distinction between, like, how banks lend money, you know. It's like, it's not fair that you know, that people like me are being, and I'm sure many Americans, are being punished because banks were just taking everybody. I mean, even people who couldn't pay back the loans, you know what I'm saying? You know, they got us. They got loans from us, and we're good for what we did. You know, we were smart, but they allowed people to buy things they couldn't afford. And I really think that banks were a large part of the responsibility and problem with the housing bubble, because they kept on lending money for houses, which probably the houses weren't worth that much. Now, a friend of mine was telling me, well, that was the value of the house at the time. And I'm like, that's not the value. I said, there must be a way of determining the real value of the house. Because when you buy a house, right, when you get generally the escrow, when they do taxes on it, the town taxes you on it, their value of the house is a lot lower than what the real estate market is, except where I live. They ripped me off. But anyway, what was I going to say? I said there must be a way of valuing the house. And he goes, well, it's supply and demand. At the time, the supply was, you know, low and the demand was high. And so that was the value of the house. But that's wrong because at that time we had people bidding who couldn't pay. It's like going on eBay and people are bidding who could never afford to pay what they're even bidding. They're just bidding because they can bid, you know? I mean, there has to be a way of determining the value of a house based on the income of people, you know, in an area. So if the mean income is, you know, $50,000, houses shouldn't be more than X amount of dollars, because if people are making $50,000, right, they can only afford, you know, so much to pay for a house, plus they have to pay for things like heating and maintenance and all this other stuff. So that takes away, that should take away from the price of the house. You know, that's one small part, the price of the house. But then you have greedy developers who, you know, are looking to turn, make a fast buck, and these people who are ripping off, you know, who are, you know, rip-off artists, you know, selling houses to people who can't afford it, and you know, increase. I don't know. It's crooked. But the thing is that it has happened so, like, no one has taken responsibility. No one wants to take responsibility, and everybody points their fingers. And then when these banks fail, they want to be saved. You know, my point, my thing is that when these big banks go, they should be broken up into smaller banks, right? And there should be much bigger. There should be regulations as to how much a house is worth. There should be guidelines, governmental guidelines, saying that 90% of your population, right, is making this dollar amount. Right? Let's talk about Boston. Your population's only making $30,000 a year, most people, let's say, right, or $40,000 a year, then, you know, the value of the housing should only be this. I mean, you can't have people living there, right? If, you know, it's like, you know, what it means is that what it would do is it would help people to actually pay just what they can, you know, what they can afford, so they can save for the future. You know, so they can save and buy a house someday. You know, it's fine to keep the 20%, but you have to keep a cap on the expenses that people are paying for apartments and houses now. You know what I mean? It's to control the inflation, because, you know, I guess I'm saying is supply and demand is dead because it can be easily manipulated, and there's nothing natural about it. You know, people talk about capitalism as the natural way to go or whatever. There's nothing natural about capitalism. There's nothing natural about the theory of supply and demand. Let's just say that. Capitalism is capitalism, but the theory of supply and demand needs to be re-evaluated, especially when it comes to real estate and houses and people's lives, you know. That's all I have to say, and that's it. So, whatever, Mary. I'm not a communist, so fuck yourself.
The Reverie of Poor Susan by William Wordsworth. At the corner of Wood Street, when daylight appears, hangs a thrush that sings loud. It has sung for 3 years. Poor Susan has passed by the spot and has heard, in the silence of morning, the song of the bird. 'Tis a note of enchantment. What ails her? She sees a mountain ascending, a vision of trees, bright volumes of vapors through Lothbury glide, and a river flows on through the vale of Cheapside.
green pastures she views in the midst of the dale, down which she so often has tripped with her pail, and a single small cottage, a nest like a dove's, the one only dwelling on earth that she loves. She looks, and her heart is in heaven, but they fade, the mist and the river, the hill and the shade. The stream will not flow, and the hill will not rise, and the colors have all passed away from her eyes. You've been listening to The Flatus Show. You can reach me at flatusshow@gmail.com or come by and visit my website at theflatusshow.com. Thank you for listening.